Thank you.
The law in this state is clear. When attacked by multiple assailants, a person has a reasonable right to use force against one member of the group to repel an attack by the entire group. And that in a multiple assailants case, the jury must consider the totality of the circumstances, including the number of people reasonably appearing to be threatening the accused, in determining both the reasonableness of the accused's belief in the necessity of force in the first instance and the reasonableness of the degree of force employed. Now, Colorado has approved of several ways in which the jury may be properly instructed in a multiple assailants case regarding self-defense, but there's always been one thing that a self-defense instruction absolutely cannot do. The self-defense instruction absolutely, in a multiple assailants case, cannot limit the jury's consideration to the threat posed by a single assailant, yet that's exactly what occurred in this case. The evidence established that Mr. Peñalanda faced a concerted attack by no less than four members of the Avila family, three of whom were admitted members of a violent rival street gang. Yet, even if the jury believes that Mr. Pena's actions were reasonable in light of the threat posed by the Avila family as a whole, the jury instruction precluded the jury from acquitting on that basis in violation of Mr. Peñalanda's constitutional rights to a fair trial, present a defense, and to prove beyond a reasonable doubt of every element of the charged offense. And here we're talking about the element of the affirmative defense of self-defense.
There were very different stories given by the various participants as to who was fighting with whom. So when you said that it's established that there were four people fighting, I mean, there was evidence to that effect, but that was disputed, wasn't it?
The Attorney General does not dispute that this was a large fight, that everyone is fighting everyone. And I would also point out that this is a self-defense case in which the defendant testified, Mr. Peñalanda testified, that he was being attacked by everybody at once. There were punches flying right and left. He believed he was going to be beaten to death. He was testified that he was followed to his car, which is just a few steps away, just a parking spot or two away from the fight was happening. He was followed there by members of the Avila family while retrieving his gun. And the fight continued. The state's own witnesses testified that everyone is rolling around on the ground, everyone is fighting everyone. This is a big melee. The difficulty in this case is that most members of the Avila family testified that they were very drunk. It was also difficult to see because it was at night. There was some lighting in the parking lot, but it was kind of difficult to differentiate who's fighting who, but Mr. Peñalanda testified that he felt that he was the center of the attack and that he was taking blows from all directions.
How was he able to get to his car and open it and retrieve the gun if he had several people attacking him at the time? Did he explain that in the testimony?
I don't think there was anything specific about the mechanics of how that occurred. We don't know how many people were attacking him. And you know, what I recognize maybe from the court's question is that, you know, the jury was free to disagree, but if they did believe Mr. Peñalanda's testimony and they believed testimony of other witnesses that he was being attacked by many people, or at the very least he faced this concerted attack, these were all members of the same family, also members of the same gang, and the law states that Mr. Peñalanda can use self-defense against one member of a group to repel the attack of the group as a whole. And I do think that the evidence shows that that's what occurred here. Now, of course, you know, the jury can go one way, the jury can go other way. This was a highly disputed case. But the problem is that if the jury did believe Mr. Peñalanda, they had no basis on which to acquit him. If they did believe his actions were reasonable in light of a concerted attack by multiple assailants, the jury instruction precluded them from acquitting him on that basis.
Counsel, I think implicit in Judge Miller's question was kind of the idea of where does the self-defense come from in this case? Because ordinarily what we see is we don't ordinarily see a claim of self-defense where the defendant is able to extricate himself from the fight, go get a gun, and come back to the fight. That seems kind of odd. Well, I mean, what's the self-defense? There was no defense of others' defense in this case, because Mr. Peñalanda insisted that he was by himself.
Right.
So he's not getting the gun to protect anybody else, so he extricates himself from the melee and gets a gun and comes back. How is that self-defense?
Well, Your Honor, no one disputed that Mr. Peñalanda was entitled to a defense of self-defense. And I would note that in this state, the law says that there's no duty to retreat. As to whether Mr. Peñalanda was the initial aggressor, the evidence is very much disputed on that. He testified that Fernando Avila shoulder checked him first. Fernando Avila, for what it's worth, couldn't remember whether he threw the first punch or not. And I do want to clarify that this is not a case where Mr. Peñalanda leaves the fight, walks several blocks to a car, has sort of a cooling off period, comes back, and then puts himself right back into the fray. The evidence showed that Mr. Peñalanda's car was right there. And although the state argued he could have kept going, he is in fear of his life. He testified, "I thought I was going to be beaten to death." That is why he retrieves the gun. Most testified that his first shot, they perceived as a warning shot. He said it was a warning shot to try to break up the fight. It had the opposite effect on the Avila family. They renewed the intensity of their fight. Ruben Avila told the officer that the family was kicking their asses at this point. And under our Colorado law, Mr. Peñalanda was entitled to reasonably defend himself. So, you know, there are questions, inferences can go both ways in this case, but the fact of the matter is that it was a multiple assailants case, and the one thing Colorado law does not allow in instructing the jury in a multiple assailants case is for the jury to be instructed that they can only consider the threat posed by one assailant. And that is the jury instruction we got here. We got the very instruction that from what we can tell, the very instruction that the Colorado Supreme Court struck down in Jones in the 1980s. And the Jones rule stands to this day, notwithstanding the state's arguments to the contrary. People v. Riley affirmed the Jones rule. They applied the Jones rule. In Riley, the defendant got not just the pattern self-defense instruction, which unlike here did not name one person, it just said victim, plus they got the apparent necessity instruction, which the court found to be very persuasive because of the additional broad language it added. We don't have anything like that here. We don't have the apparent necessity instruction that we had in Riley. We don't have the pattern self-defense instruction that we had in Riley and some other cases. We don't have the totality of the circumstances instruction that we saw in Manzanares. There is, I would submit, no reasonable way to read this instruction that would have allowed the jury to consider the threat Mr. Peñalanda faced by multiple members of the Avila family. It was not just Ruben Avila that Mr. Peñalanda was struggling with. The state's witnesses testify that at any given point, Ruben Avila was fighting directly with Mr. Peñalanda. Fernando Avila was fighting with Mr. Peñalanda. Jesse Avila was fighting with Mr. Peñalanda. Both before and after the shots are fired, this fight continues. It is a large melee in which Mr. Peñalanda's reasonableness in needing to obtain a gun and use the gun has to be judged in light of that increased threat, but the jury was precluded from any consideration of that factor. And the law says that this is an element in the totality of the circumstances the jury must consider. Not the jury may consider, the jury must consider it.
Ms. Cruz, can you, before your time runs out, could you address the people's argument that this wasn't plain error because the evidence of guilt was overwhelming?
Yes, Your Honor, and as I put forth in my reply brief, I disagree wholeheartedly that the evidence here was overwhelming. The evidence here was very much confused and disputed, but the state's witnesses testified that this is a huge fight. They're kicking Mr. Peñalanda's ass. It's not until two more members of the Avila family join in the brawl that Mr. Pena-Landa retrieves his gun. And that's unlike some other cases like Manzanares, where the defensive action sort of was a jumping of the gun, so to speak. Here, he is engaged in this fist fight until it becomes overwhelming, he retrieves his gun. And this was one of our primary theories of defense, which the jury was never able to consider. I don't think under these circumstances you could say that the evidence is overwhelming. If the jury did believe Mr. Pena-Landa, they could not acquit him because the law, as they were given, precluded him from that. If there are no further questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. You have 3 minutes and 14 seconds. Ms. Wiggins?
May it please the court, Nicole Wiggins, registration number 42702, appearing on behalf of the people today. Your Honors, the instruction that was given in this case was not plain error for two reasons. The first is that the facts of this case did not clearly indicate that the defendant was being attacked by multiple assailants such that the court should have been on notice to sua sponte give the jury a multiple assailant instruction. What all of the applicable
cases... Wasn't there testimony, though, to that effect? I mean, when you say the court wasn't clearly on notice, I mean, the court heard the testimony.
Yes, Your Honor, the court heard the testimony, and the defense never once uttered the word multiple assailant, totality of the circumstances. The defense did not bring this to the court's attention, which is why this is under the plain error review. And under that review, what we're essentially saying is the court should have stopped the proceedings on its own and said, we must instruct the jury on this. And the evidence wasn't clear enough for the court to interject itself in the proceedings to say we need to instruct the jury on this when the defense never requested or even addressed such an instruction.
But counsel, isn't the law clear that the evidence doesn't have to be clear, it doesn't have to be undisputed, there just has to be some evidence? In fact, I think the bar is very low. It has to be any evidence to support an instruction. And wouldn't the court know that as long as there's any evidence that it has to give an instruction?
Your Honor, that's true. And when a defense requests an instruction, the standard uses, is there a scintilla of evidence? But in a situation like this where the defense has never brought this up or brought it to the court's attention, a lot of cases actually caution the court against interjecting itself and instructing the jury without the parties requesting that. The scintilla of evidence is more used in this on review when the defense requests the instruction, which is not what happened in this case.
If the defendant had requested the instruction, would you concede error and reversible error?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that under any review of this case, the instruction in this case restricted the jury from considering the totality of the circumstances. I think that Beckett and Riley make it clear that it could not be plain error, but I don't think it is error at all because I don't think the instruction limited the jury's consideration. And I think reading Beckett, Beckett would say that it's not error and would not even go towards plain error. So
you think the term victim used in the instruction, which the Supreme Court said includes the plural, here the victim's name was specifically set forth. I'm not really understanding how that could be deemed to be the plural.
Yes, Your Honor. The pattern instruction uses the word victim. The only case that I've located that also inserts the victim's name is Beckett. Now, both are accurate, and I submit there's no difference, and no case has held that substituting the victim's name has a limiting effect on the instruction. And as I stated, Beckett is the only case that happens, and Beckett approves of the instruction, so there's no error there. Similar to stating just the victim, stating the victim's name doesn't limit the jury's consideration of the totality of the circumstances, which is the concern here, because the threat posed by the victim, whether named or not, necessarily includes the attendant circumstances surrounding him. That's why the instruction includes the language reasonably believed. And to presume that the jury ignored the circumstances surrounding the confrontation between defendant and Ruben, as it is in this case, is to assume that they're ignoring evidence that they haven't been told to ignore, when in fact they've been instructed to consider all of the evidence. So I don't think there's an appreciable difference, Your Honor, in actually inserting the victim's name because the instruction, nowhere in the instruction does the court tell the jury you cannot consider the other circumstances that you've heard all day today, essentially.
Where does it say that they can or should consider all those circumstances?
It does not expressly say that they can. However, the defense's argument is that this instruction somehow limited the jury's consideration. And while it doesn't expressly open it, it certainly does not expressly disclose it or limit it. So in this case, you know, aside from the fact that the facts did not alert the court to give this instruction, to presume that inserting a name somehow is telling the jury, well, you can't pay attention to the rest of this evidence, when the court also expressly instructs the jury to consider all of the evidence, would make this situation not error, Your Honor, because I don't think that it limits the jury's consideration in the way the defense suggests.
I mean, your office frequently argues that we must presume that the jury followed the instructions.
Yes, Your Honor.
Aren't you going counter to that in your argument today?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. I'm assuming still that the jury followed the instructions. What I'm saying is that the instruction in this case did not limit the jury's consideration of all the relevant evidence.
Let me make, and your basis for that is the phrase reasonably believed that
incorporates. Yes, Your Honor, that is in part in what I'm basing most of this on, because the instruction still tells the jury that the defendant must have been acting reasonably. And was it reasonable for the defendant to act the way he did? And I don't think that the instruction limits the jury's consideration. All of the evidence is available for the jury to consider when the essential instruction is, did the defendant act reasonably?
Well, counsel, I guess I'm having trouble with that argument because you're just taking the phrase reasonably believed out of the sentence. We have to read the rest of the sentence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Reasonably believed to be the use of unlawful physical force by the victim's name.
Yes.
So reasonably believed is expressly limited to force used by the victim's name, the particular victim.
Your Honor, the instruction reads the threat reasonably posed by the victim, I believe. And what I'm saying is I don't think that it's reasonable to presume the jury is going to divorce the victim from the attendant circumstances. So when the jury is instructed, consider the threat, in this case, imposed by Ruben Avila, I believe that it would be erroneous to assume that the jury is going to exclude all the other evidence. The threat posed by the victim includes the attendant circumstances that the victim brings to the situation. Is the victim armed? Is the victim a very large man? These are all things that the jury considers when considering the threat imposed by the victim, and we don't necessarily need to instruct the jury on all of that.
And you're saying that a jury most likely would interpret that phrase to mean, even though it says only the particular victim that's an issue in this case, it really meant anybody else that was around.
That is not necessarily what I'm saying, Your Honor. I'd like to limit it more to the fact that when it said that the victim comes with his own circumstances. So when you're naming the victim, it's not limiting the jury's consideration. And the concern here is not so much that we precisely instruct the jury in every self-defense thing that could have applied in this case. The issue here on appeal is whether this instruction was erroneously limiting. And I don't think by simply inserting a name, it's not limiting, and under Beckett, it certainly is not limiting. The same exact instruction was given there and was found not to be error. In that case, they did insert the victim's name, and no case has limited or commented on that to say that by inserting the victim's name, you have now altered this instruction to be limiting.
Well, counsel,
go ahead, Your Honor.
If we were just left with Jones, forget any case after that, would you be conceding error in this case?
No, Your Honor, because I still think that the instruction doesn't limit the jury.
Well, that was the argument rejected in Jones. I mean, in Jones, the victim was named just like here. It's the same instruction, and the court reversed. So, I mean, are you really saying that if we were left with Jones, it wouldn't be error?
No, Your Honor, I think that you do need to read, right?
Just Jones. So your argument.
So you're saying both. Just Jones. Forget
just
about
Jones.
Okay. I think under Judge Jones, then there would be an issue, because
right.
Jones uses mandatory language and says that it must be considered, it must be separately addressed. So I think under Jones, there would be more of an issue. However, I think Beckett and Riley completely foreclose that issue in this case. I think Riley makes particularly clear by refusing essentially to address whether the instruction given in this case was error. Basically, makes the situation not plain error, Your Honor, because when you read Riley and Beckett in conjunction or even reading either of them alone, there's no way that this is plain error when the Beckett court is saying the pattern instruction, which includes the victim's name, is sufficient to instruct the jury on the reasonableness of the defendant's self-defense in the totality of the circumstances.
But didn't those cases also include an instruction that said exactly what you've been saying, that the jury has to consider all of the facts and circumstances?
Your Honor, in the sense that it was a separate self-defense instruction, no, not all of them did. In Riley, there was a separate apparent necessity instruction. In Beckett, the only instruction tendered was the instruction that was tendered in this case. There was no separate instruction in Beckett directing the jury to consider the totality of the circumstances, which is why Justice Coates takes the position he does in the Riley concurrence. Clearly, he seizes on that, and he views Beckett as essentially overruling Jones.
Well, but that's a separate opinion. We have to apply the
yes, Your Honor.
Opinion of the court, not a concurring or dissenting opinion of a separate justice.
Yes, Your Honor. And then the issue that makes this very clearly plain error is that the majority addresses that concurrence and says we refuse to address whether Beckett altered Jones. So without the Supreme Court, I guess, basically leaving that issue out there, there is no law that says that this error at the time of this trial or now was obvious and substantial. It can't be obvious and substantial if the Supreme Court refuses to say that it's error. So the concurrence, I understand, Your Honor, is only persuasive. However, the majority's note saying we refuse to address this issue places this in a realm where it cannot be plain error, particularly given that the instruction given here is exactly the same that was approved by the Supreme Court in Beckett.
In Beckett, did the Supreme Court say that it was overruling Jones?
No, it did not, Your Honor. Beckett actually cited Jones with approval, but did not squarely address it in the sense of a multiple assailant situation, which is what adds a little bit of confusion to the situation, because other courts have taken Beckett and cited it for that, but Beckett didn't opine on Jones in the sense of multiple assailant situation. It did cite the instruction given in Jones with approval, and then went on to say that the pattern instruction, which in that case included the name of the victim, was sufficient to apprise the jury of self-defense in totality of the circumstances. So, Your Honor, I do think, based on Beckett and Riley, that even if the facts apply so that the court was that we were to presume that it was error to sua sponte fail to give that instruction, which I wholeheartedly submit it was not. Even if it was, based on Beckett and Riley, there can be no plain error in this case, Your Honor.
I want to ask a quick question.
Sure.
Just to make sure I'm clear on what the parties are or are not contending, and that is, are you disputing whether a self-defense instruction was justified at all?
No, Your Honor, I'm not disputing that. The prosecution tendered the self-defense instruction. Defense counsel expressly agreed with it, which is another reason why the court should not have been on error to further instruct the jury. I'm not saying that self-defense didn't apply at all. I'm saying, particularly in light of the jury's special interrogatories in this case, it's clear and the evidence was overwhelming that the jury rejected the defendant's self-defense claim. In that sense, any error here was further harmless or further not plain error. Also, in regards to a further harmlessness analysis when assessing the issue, Your Honors, the Court of Appeals in Riley, even though it found error, found it to be harmless, citing several factors, a couple of which were that the jury was instructed to consider all of the evidence, which did happen here, and also that defense counsel was free to argue in closing and did argue in closing that multiple people were involved in this fight and that the defendant acted reasonably based on his appearances. And in this case, similarly, the defense counsel argued in closing that it was Reuben and defendant were in a fight and that the gun accidentally discharged, but that there were a lot of people around and there was a gang element, and so defendant was right to be afraid. So I think in assessing the harmlessness of what happened in this case, Court of Appeals Riley is instructive in that sense, and that they did find error in instructions similar to this, but found it harmless. And in this case, Also, one of the errors in Jones that was not present here is that the court in Jones specifically told counsel and that he could not argue a multiple assailant defense in closing. And that did not happen here. In closing, the defense counsel actually focused on the singular conflict between defendant and Rubin and argued that it was an accident. So if your honors have no further questions, based on the fact that the facts of this case did not put the court on a notice to sua sponte, instruct the jury, and based on the precedent set in Riley and Beckett, there can be no plain error in this case, and the people ask that you uphold the convictions.
Thank you, Ms. Whitt.
Thank you, your honors.
Ms. Cruz?
Okay, just a couple of points. The Attorney General's left off there with the defendant's arguments in closing. The defendant argued sort of a tiered closing argument, and she focuses on just one piece of that, which is that as to the charge of first degree intentional after deliberation murder, he emphasizes the facts that show that this could have just been an accident. However, he then moves on to the next portion of his argument, which is that if the jury does not believe it was an accident, Mr. Pena-Londo was nevertheless justified in using self-defense. And that's when he talks about the circumstances of the large fight, the threat that Rubin was facing, because the prosecution's theory was that Mr. Pena-Londo's actions were unreasonable. He brought a gun to a mere fist fight. That is why it was so crucial that the jury be able to consider the multiple assailants aspect of this case, because that was one of the state's primary theories.
Counsel, before you run out of time, could you tell me what are the principled or significant differences between the instruction at issue in this case and the instruction at issue in Beckett?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I wanted to address Beckett because I think the reason why there's some confusion here is because the state has left out some very critical facts about Beckett. In Beckett, the defendant did not have a multiple assailant theory of defense. Their theory of defense was apparent necessity, because the facts of that case was that before there was much of a threat, Mr. Beckett drew a gun, or I believe it was a gun, and so the defense counsel wanted the jury to really understand that regardless of whether there was some actual threat, it was, if the threat was apparent or as it appeared to the defendant, then he should be able to act in self-defense. So the whole issue in that case was about apparent necessity, and the Riley court explicitly calls Beckett a single assailant case. That's how the Supreme Court describes its own precedent. It is not a multiple assailants case. And as Justice Bender points out in his dissent in further detail, the court had no occasion to even comment on multiple assailants in that case. That's why that case does not apply, as I have argued in my brief. In all other respects, though, the instruction was proper, and the court found that that was sufficient for apparent necessity, not for multiple assailants. I also want to say that defense counsel did not expressly approve of the instruction in this case. Based on the record, what he was approving was the Pickering rule, that it be applied in some different circumstances for reckless versus intentional. And I do want to clarify, the state repeatedly says here today and in its brief, the issue in this case is the trial court's failure to sua sponte give a multiple assailants case or instruction. That is not the issue before this court today. The issue before this court today is the giving of an erroneous self-defense instruction. Even if defense counsel had asked the court to give us instruction, the court could not have, because it's an incorrect statement of the law. I see that my time's run out. I ask that the court reverse Mr. Pena-Londo's convictions, remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your excellent arguments today. The case is submitted and we'll render a decision in due course.